Good afternoon, Sue, and welcome to our studio.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
For our listeners, let's say that we have a Sue Jennings from Great Britain here with us, who is conducting a special workshop. So how it is, today is the third day, yeah? Mm. The workshop will be going on until Friday.
Mm-hmm.
What is the workshop about?
Well, the title of the workshop is a Neurodramatic Play, which is very much to do with the very early life of the child, from 6 months before birth to 6 months after birth, and the types of play that happen during that time, which includes sensory play, messy play, rhythmic play, and dramatic interactive play. And for children that have missed out on these stages, they really don't develop according to their life plan, so to speak. And we need, as teachers or as therapists, to go back and rework those stages with children. These children may have been rejected, neglected, they may have been abused. And with this traumatic development, their development stops at whatever age the trauma happened. So we work through play and through drama in this way.
To rebuild it.
Rebuild the connections. We had a lot of fun this week, and the first day we were doing messy play. People were playing with shaving foam and flour and water and finger paints and got it all over themselves, but had a lot of fun. And the model of the course is that I'm working with staff in the mornings, and then children come in the afternoons, and the staff apply what they learnt in the morning with the children.
So, it's really
that
practical.
Makes it a very rich day.
It's really practical. That workshop, that kind of therapy, did you develop by yourself, or it's a product of more?
Well, play therapy as such exists, and there are various forms of it. And a lot of play therapy is to do with attachment. And most of the theorists have said that attachment doesn't start till sort of a year old. Well, my belief is that attachment starts before the baby's even born. So if you're right, that play therapy exists, neurodramatic play is my own research and development.
And you're saying the attachment starts before, but the child is attached to the mother, no?
Well, a lot of what I know, I learnt from my research, and I did research with a tribe in the Malaysian rainforest, and I took my own children there, and we lived there for a year and a half, studying how they reared their children and why their children were non-competitive, non-violent.
Which tribe is that?
It was quite extraordinary, and when I'd heard about this tribe, I was a bit sceptical. But I actually found that this was true, that mothers and fathers never hit their children, yet their children grow up to be very calm, interactive, generous people. And generosity is their main ethos. So if you hear somebody call somebody else mean, that's the biggest insult you could call them, because it means you're not sharing.
Makes sense.
So a society based on a sharing ethos, it's really quite something.
Your major profession, so to speak, or line of study was anthropology, right?
Yeah, my first training was in theatre, and I was a professional theatre artist for some years, both as a dancer and as an actor. And I was asked in my late teens by a neighbourhood psychiatrist if I'd go and work in his hospital. This was quite sort of just happened. So all I knew was drama and theatre, so that's what I was doing, and I got very interested in the possibilities of therapeutic drama. So, I mean, that's, what, 60 years ago or more when I did that. And out of that experience, I went to work in special education. And again, the drama and theatre worked when other methods didn't. So out of that came the development of drama as a therapy. So drama therapy was my first work. Through drama therapy, I got more and more interest in play therapy. And out of that then came the neurodramatic play. So it's gone in that sort of sequencing.
You do work with children who have some kind of traumas. And I think I read somewhere you also work with other people or elder with dementia and stuff like that. Do you have a feeling that maybe there's a rise of children decades after the Second War with difficulties, and also maybe there's a rise of children with special needs, like autistic children, attention deficit disorders, and other, I mean, there are plenty of...
It would seem categories. To be on the increase.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most worrying aspects is children growing up with a lack of empathy.
Mm.
And that is really worrying, because children without empathy can commit quite horrific crimes.
Dissociate
and lack the understanding of how the other person feels. Well, empathy starts to develop very early between mother and baby. It's part of the attachment of feeling how the other person is feeling. But the whole theme of attachment seems to be being challenged at the moment, because more and more mothers have to work and are having to get childminders, giving their children to other people to look after. And every baby needs an attachment figure in the first 2 years of life.
Mm-hmm.
So the quality of care may not be good enough. The child may be in a kindergarten for babies, or be handed over to another relative who doesn't necessarily understand attachment. So I think that is the first difficulty. And the second difficulty, I think, is to do with technology.
Okay.
That younger and younger children be given screens, when we know from neuroscience that screens damage the brain of the young child. You know, children looking at screen for any length of time under the age of five is a very serious situation, part because of the flickering light, but also...
It's a radioactive art for that, nonetheless, I mean, apart from other things.
The screen deadens part of the brain.
Yeah, the same the mobile phones, no?
Yeah. So I think that is another contribution.
Mm.
And I do think, I mean, obviously I've not been in Oroville long enough to see how it is here, so I can only talk from a Western experience.
Yeah.
But education is getting more and more test-focused, stats-focused.
Well, it's like an industry now.
And what I call tick-box education.
Or industry, the track where you produce the best.
Yeah. Rather than children... actually learning to understand what they're learning, you know. There's a lot of rote learning, a lot of memory tests, and it's not what I call education. The other thing is that the arts are suffering in education with the big cutbacks we have in England.
Mm-hmm.
Art, music, drama, dance, all these things have been cut back.
Mm-hmm.
And yet... anybody that knows anything about the brain knows that we need the arts to help the right hemisphere of the brain function.
Yeah, there's a known correlation between listening the Western classical music to development of the maths ability,
yeah? Mm-hmm.
Because it's the frequency, the music does work its own path, and it does develop the logic of mathematics, no?
Mm.
But you have a feeling that all these factors you listed are the reason there is more and more children with no empathy and other dysfunctional...
Yes, I do. Those, for me, it is those main three aspects, which taken together means that a child is very deprived.
Uh-huh.
Lack of a healthy attachment, or good enough attachment, shall we say. Lack of a nurturing environment, and... too much screens, and it actually is for the tick box approach to education.
Mm-hmm.
I think those collectively are contributing to a lot of the troubles we have. And I mean, at one time...
But what about those children with special needs who are born with, so to speak, categorized in one of the boxes, so to speak, to deal with them, but they are not... I mean, to say normal is a harsh word. Let's say they don't fit into these categories because they see and they function in the world different than, so to speak, normal children.
Mm.
Do you have an idea what is the cause for that?
I think we aren't honest enough about special education.
Mm-hmm.
That children with a lot of difficulties actually can learn if we allow them to, and have the right environment, have the right staff ratio. And people just have lost the patience now working with special education.
Also in the classroom, the teachers don't have patience to deal with a child with a special needs if it's, you know, the child is put in his peers, right?
And there's this belief among some people that children, teenagers, adults who with special needs can only learn through rote learning, through repetition, that they don't have a developed imagination. But this is just not true.
That's not true.
And I've worked right across the age range with people with special needs, and they certainly do have an imagination and are very, very creative. Yeah, you mentioned actually about me working as well with older people.
You were saying the elders. How do you deal with because also the rise of Alzheimer, Parkinson's disease, and the dementia of older people?
The research into the causes of Alzheimer's is progressing extremely well. We may be on the verge of actually understanding more why it develops, because you know part of the brain has ceased to function. Now the interesting thing is that people think that the way to slow down your brain deteriorating is to do lots of brain games and Sudoku and crosswords and so on, and that will stop you deteriorating. Well, the opposite is found to be true. It's not the brain games, it's if you dance. So creative dance, creative drama, use of the body, all the yoga, the deep breathing, the mindfulness, all of that has proved to slow down the development of dementia. And there's some amazing work going on with the dance therapists now, working with people with dementia, making huge, huge differences. So I think we mustn't be too pessimistic. Yes, dementia and Alzheimer's on the increase, but it's not necessarily going to take over because we are finding out an awful lot. But certainly there are various threads now in the research that they're demonstrating that certain substances seem to increase the development of dementia rather rapidly. But you see, it's not just what we do to slow it down, it's also the environment that we're now in. Because too many people give up and feel that a home is the only answer. And that's very sad when somebody is removed from their home environment. But on the other hand, you can see the demands made on a family when somebody develops, usually grandma or grandpa, develops dementia. I mean, I know of one family that I worked with where the woman's husband had very extreme dementia and he'd lock her out of the house at night. He was physically very strong and she had to sleep in her car. But she was getting no support. We've got to support families where somebody in the family has dementia, because often somebody in that family is up night and day dealing with a demented relative, you know?
It's not so easy, no?
And you can understand why relatives do put people in homes in the end. But some of these homes are so institutionalised that people have lost their individuality, they haven't got their personal possessions around them. There's a very interesting experiment going on now in Denmark where they've created a village for people with dementia.
A whole village. How that looks like.
Which is amazing. So they've got all the familiar things around them that belong to all the individuals and the way of life and the things they used to do when they were younger and so on. And there are cafes where they can go and have meet their mates for a coffee. But there are care staff obviously around as well. But the whole environment is a familiar one.
To them. Okay.
And I'm waiting to see the results of it all because it absolutely sounds fascinating.
It sounds really interesting. Okay, let's come back to this city of Dawn. What brought you to Orville? I mean, how you are connected?
I'm only connected through Marion.
Oh, through Marion.
And Marion and I knew each other 50 years ago. We worked together in drama and special needs. She's a very, very good teacher. And we were very close friends. But we haven't actually seen each other for 30 years. Because she was travelling, I was travelling. And our paths just didn't cross. And then we found each other again, and she'd already moved here. Mm. And she said, I really want to bring you over to Oroville. Will you come? And I said, of course I'll come.
Did she say why? It must be the reason.
She wanted to share my approach to play and drama and neuroscience with people, local people who would be interested.
And you're conducting the workshop in Unity Pavilion the whole week, this week. And there are teachers participating, and in the afternoon you have also children.
With all sorts of people there. We've got teachers, we've got therapists, we've got support workers, a whole range. And I think they're quite exhausted by day three. They've worked them very, very hard.
I believe so, because I was reading the program, and it seems like quite a lot to take in, no? And to process it. So you're aiming to qualify, so to speak, or, you know, at least train this group of 24 people?
Well,
to
5 days won't give people a qualification, but it will give them a certificate.
But it will
a certificate in neurodramatic play issued by our company. And if anybody wants to go on and do more, then we offer online training as well. So they could actually work towards a diploma without having to go off somewhere else. They can do it online if that's feasible for them. But people will have a certificate, which means that the basic principles they can apply. Excuse me. Neurodramatic play is not rocket science. It is extremely simple to get once people are into it, when they realise that the brain is a playful instrument. Brains want to play. So if you hook body and brain together to play, that's neurodramatic play.
Okay, so it's like, how does it look? I mean, I'm curious. Neurodramatic play, so it's like people are acting or they're moving around?
Well, the initial stage is always to do with the body. So the body's small in terms of sensory play, finger painting and so on, and then large movement using dance movement and so on. So it covers a whole range of body experience. That's your groundwork. That's like the scaffolding. And then onto that, you then develop projective play, which is very much to do with clay, drawing, painting, modelling, building. But out of messy play always comes form. And it's very interesting to observe children, because people say, oh, if you let them do messy play, they'll always do it. But that's actually not true. Children will do messy play for a certain length of time and then want to create shapes and form and so on. So we use a lot of, say, clay work, painting, modelling of all sorts. And then the third step is very much into role and to the drama. So I might make a painting of a monster, but the next step is for me to be that monster. And the children today actually made monster masks. And then we had lots of fabric and chairs in the room, and they built a shelter for their monster. And then we acted just a little drama about the monster coming out to explore and so on.
Yeah, through the playing the roles, usually the moments of trauma or abuses, they do come forward, no? Or you can recognize?
Yes, I think what we need to sort of be more flexible about is that people often think that using roles is sort of quite formal, playing a character and they interact, but it starts before that. You can be a role, but non-verbally. You don't have to say a word to be a character. So you're building up all those creative ideas, first of all, in your body, before you ever add words to them, because some people can't speak anyway. So we try to take away from this urgency of having to use language until people feel confident to use language. And we set up tiny little interactions, and slowly those become bigger scenes, and eventually they become plays. And I include quite a lot of work on Shakespeare in my work. And a colleague of mine, she's called Kelly Hunter, she discovered that Shakespeare's verse is the same beat as a human heartbeat.
Hmm.
It's very interesting. Ta-tum, ti-tum, ta-ta, ta-ta. That's your heartbeat. And she does a lot of work with children with special needs, especially on the autistic spectrum, using Shakespeare, with amazing results. Using the imagery, using the actions, using the metaphors and so on.
So what happens with the children when they go through one of those neurodramatic play, I mean, or sessions of them? Mm. What is the result?
Well, it'll partly depend what they've been referred for. Mm-hmm. If they've been referred therapeutically.
Yeah.
And I'll be asked to deal with behaviour issues, etc. Or emotional struggles. Or childhood trauma. Now, my playroom has every sort of thing you need for playing. Whether it's musical instruments, whether it's art materials, whether it's lots of different toys, whether it's Lego, you name it, I've got it in the playroom.
Mm-hmm.
And if a child comes individually to see me, they have a look around the playroom and choose what they want to play with.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, if you follow the child rather than leading them, they will play through what they need to play.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we call non-directive play therapy. And children, by and large, if they're damaged in any way at all, need just to be allowed to play it through.
Hmm.
Obviously, you set limits. They're not allowed to smash the room up and destroy things and run away, and they have to stay in the room and so on. But as adults, so often we want to interfere with children's play. When children are perfectly capable of playing for themselves, and even if they haven't got struggles and difficulties, children need to play as part of growing into a person.
It's a learning process, no?
Mm.
Mm. So the group of children who is participating in the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
they are from kindergarten, but they are all elder group.
Yeah. Mm. So it's one class of children. They're slightly older than kindergarten. They're amazing. They are so creative and so funny. We've been having a great time together. And they're very inventive, which is interesting. Yeah, we do a simple little exercise of one person rolls another person over the floor. Because remember, rolling is the very first action a baby does independently when they roll themselves over. Hmm?
In the womb.
So we do a whole...
Oh, all sorts of things.
Well, both.
Yeah, well,
before the and after they rolled, and we were doing. The children thought it was wonderful that they could push roll the grown ups. You see, so they started pushing, and then one child realised that you could actually use a lot of force with the top of your head. So he was rolling his partner with his head.
Wow.
And really, nobody else had thought of that.
That's really out of the box, no? It's like you would think with the hands.
That's right. So another child suddenly thought you could use your back to roll purse. So all the time, these kids were inventing new things to do. And it was so exciting to watch. Because that doesn't always happen. You know, you have to wait and wait and wait for children to develop something. But they're very lively, very energetic. Extremely well regulated, you know.
Regulated?
Yeah. You know, self-regulation in terms of their behaviour. You know, not rushing off, disappearing, going to the toilet without asking, and all those things. They were extremely well behaved. But at the same time, extremely creative. So, Auroville started doing something right.
Yeah. Well, right away, the kids are brought up in the base of integral education, which aims to find a mission of a soul in a child and let it develop at its own pace or the need of the child.
Mm. See, I think what was nice for the children as well is that every child has one designated adult.
Mm.
So they've got an adult partner for the whole week.
Well, that's great, no? That's
like so, of course, lots of attention, lots of support, lots of help and so on. Mm.
And how are the grown-ups handling the...
I'm sorry?
How the grown-ups, the teachers and the therapists, how they're handling the situation?
I think once they got over the surprise of getting flour and water all over themselves, they were fine. Mm. I think for some, it's a continuation of what they already believe in. For others, I think it's a slightly startled shift in perspective. But everybody's participating very well. Very intelligent questions, very intelligent discussion. Mm-hmm. I know they've been a nice group to teach. We're sort of over halfway through now, just got Thursday and Friday.
Mm-hmm. Nice. We'll see the results afterward, no? Because usually they are implemented quite right away, no?
Mm. Well, I do hope it carries over into the day-to-day life, at least of the school. Mm.
Did you have a chance maybe to peek in which are the problems, or it's like which are the major things that the teachers and the therapists are dealing with?
Mm. And, like a case example, yeah?
Yes. Mm. I mean,
well, I've got a very funny case example, actually, yeah. But it also shows the principles. Oh. And I always use it when I'm teaching people, follow the child. And this was a boy of 7 who came from a very chaotic household. You know, you ate when you felt like it, you curled up on the sofa to sleep if you were tired. There was no rhythm of the family life at all. And he was clumsy and kept dropping things and so on. And he came to play therapy, looked around the playroom, got the big sandbox. I use a round sand tray. Mm-hmm. Got a bucket of water, tipped it in the sand, got another bucket of water, climbed into the sand and tipped this bucket of water over himself.
Wow.
Children rarely get in the sand tray. They'll play with it, with the toys. Yeah. And but this is what he wanted to do, and he was playing a splashy-splashy. Mm. And that went on for 12 weeks. And suddenly then he changed. He didn't want to be in the water anymore. He was going to be outside the water and actually using the sand tray in a more conventional sense. Not using the toys. Mm. Using his hands, making shapes, burying his hands and so on. And then a few weeks later, he got the toys and started lining them up in rows. Then he started, a few weeks later, letting the toys interact. And then he started using them to make a story. So if you think about it, what that boy had done was to direct himself right through from messy play to order, to shape, to form, to narrative.
Creation.
Which was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And that was self-directed, that he did what he needed to do. Mm. And I was most impressed. And out of that came a far more ordered life for himself. He was much more self-regulated, even though the family wasn't abusive. They weren't nasty. They were just chaotic. But he learnt to manage himself in the chaos much better.
Well, that's good. No, I mean, also here, did you notice certain patterns maybe or difficulties that we are dealing here? Or in?
You mean with adults and children here in,
yes,
Oroville?
Yeah.
Oh, that's too early to say, really. I mean, I have noticed that they've got a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of energy.
Mm.
And they're willing to take risks.
Okay.
And that was great, both the adults and the children. I think the concept of non-directive play, even though Oroville has a philosophy of children developing at their own pace, it doesn't quite carry over into education in terms of play development. Because,
okay,
when we got the kids in, yeah, people wanted to help them and help them move on. And then I was saying, slow down. Hmm. The child will tell you where they want to go.
Oh, okay.
And things after I'd said that, the adults slowed right down and let the children take the initiative. But you know, they so much wanted the kids to succeed and produce a lovely picture or make a lovely mask and so on. But they learnt, yeah, the adults learnt very quickly. The children would do that anyway. They didn't need to direct them or whatever.
Said that you heard about it. You managing to see something as well?
So little, because you know it's a long days, and in the evening is one's preparing for the next day. I did get out to the cinema last night, but I'm having to gather the impression of our all from talking to people around me, because we're staying in the guest house, but of course that's a long way from anywhere else. So you don't really see what's going on. You know, you get a sense of it at lunchtime when you all queue up at the kitchens and so on, you know. I really ought to come here for a holiday rather than come here to work to get a full sense. But I'm finding my way little by little, but I couldn't give a fair overview of it yet.
Okay, it takes time, you'll be staying after the workshop, or you have...
I have to leave on Saturday.
You have other worker engagement?
Yes, I've got more work. I've got to go to Singapore. Because I started off in Delhi, then Bangalore, now Auroville, then Singapore,
You've
and
been
then
in
Malaysia.
Yeah,
I've been away from home quite a time now. So this was my third stop on the way.
How was the rest of the India, Bombay and Delhi? Because India, it's a different culture than England, no?
England is a very difficult place to live these days. Very difficult. I do enjoy being away, in fact.
Okay.
India are mumbling, they might be able to offer me a job. Malaysia is also mumbling, they might be able to offer me a job. And if either of them do, I shall take it. Because England is going through this absolute crisis to do with the European Union, to do with lack of money, with the austerity programme, with a very controlling ministerial level. And people are just giving up. People are applying for passports in other countries. Most of them are applying to go to Ireland. Ireland's getting a bit worried. They're going to get a whole troop of English migrants over there. So, yes, I mean, of course, there are things I miss in my own culture, and particularly theatre, because we have a very high standard of theatre in England. But on the other hand, there are plenty of other things to see and go to in the countries that I visit.
But in Bombay and Delhi, you were also offering the same programme you are offering here, the workshop on neurodramatic.
Yes, I did a whole week's programme plus a conference in Delhi, a very short programme in Bangalore because there wasn't time to stay long. Mumbai is a little holiday just for 2 days. I worked in Mumbai before, working with the boys who sleep on the railway station. And it was really, really interesting doing storytelling and play with those boys who, providing we gave them a meal, they were willing to leave the station. Because on the station is where they get their food off the trains that come through and so on. So that was the deal. We provided a good lunch, and they came to the workshop and then said, would we go and see where they lived? And it was quite an eye-opener, taking photographs with big black rats running over your feet, you know. Remarkably mature individuals.
The street smartens you and doesn't make you mature faster than it needed, no?
Well, I seem to end up working with homeless people and with people coming out of orphanages, either in India or Romania. I do a lot of work in Romania. And the orphanage era is only just coming to an end. There are still a lot of people who were in the orphanages who are very depressed and deprived, you know. So... whether it's an unconscious choice, I don't know, but I seem to end up almost always working with the dispossessed in whatever country I go to.
It's painful. I mean, it's kind of painful, and I believe you didn't grow up in this kind of environment. It hurts you when you see that, because you know that the family environment can bring up healthy and warm individuals, And yet I know that also between the homeless people and maybe dispossessed, you can find warm souls. There are many stories on this planet, and many they're not nice, and yet the people somehow they do survive. They do also amazing things out of that. So it's then on the other side you see a fully, let's so to speak, civilized world where depression is the main, as you said, people are giving up.
And what I think is interesting, you're seeing it right now with the homeless in Britain. Rather than try and solve the problem of homelessness, the government is trying to legislate. So if people are caught giving money to homeless people, they'll be fined, for example. I mean, this type of inhumane treatment. If you're seen helping a homeless person in any way at all,
you
get challenged by the police and can be fined.
That is really mean.
Now, unless people can solve homelessness, you will always have homeless people. And you will always have generous-hearted people who want to try and do a little bit to help them. Well, I'm sure you know that in England now, people have to use food banks because they don't have enough money for food. People are having zero contracts, so it gets them off the unemployment statistic, but they don't actually earn anything. And even people on low wages are having to use food banks. And England is the 8th richest country in the world. And at this day and age that we should be using food banks, you see why it's not a place I particularly want to live in. Because the value system has shifted to greed, to a stronger than ever hierarchy.
It's a survival mode. I mean, it's present in all of Europe, as far as I know. It's going that way that people, the certain rules are being in place and they are not in favor of the humans. You know, when you're in a survival mode, you become mean and you're trying to survive for yourself, then you don't think so much about the other.
Which, of course, takes me right back to the tribe again.
Because okay, that tribe actually sounds really interesting. You said to you, and also saw on your webpage that you're offering in March 2019 3 weeks workshop with that tribe.
Yes, I and my older son do this together. All the children were part of my research, but he also is an anthropologist, and he's also an anti-bullying specialist. So he does a lot of work in that area. And what we provided, we tried it the once and it was extremely successful, was taking a group of 10 people right into the jungle to live with the tribe, learn about their ways, observe how the children play, practice some playing themselves within the tribe's own culture, using their values, and seeing how peaceful coexistence is possible. So it's an amazing experience all around. And
That is for grown-ups or for children as well, that workshop?
Well, the people that came last time were a mixture of psychologists, therapists, students and teachers. It was a really rich mix. It was very nice. And they all got on together the whole time, which was also very nice. You put together a strange group of people for a short time, but it really worked.
You mentioned bullying, yeah? Because you have also the programs for anti-bullying in the companies, in the units, and so forth.
This links up with what we talked about before.
Yeah.
I mean, the child who feels disadvantaged is often the one who bully people who are more advantaged that they see it, you know? Because we use a lot of interactive play, you can nip at bullying in the right at the beginning, because you don't punish, you don't exclude, you get everyone concerned together and they start to role play these situations. But the good school does bullying preparation, so children are less likely to bully. The good school also has what we call buddies, where various pupils agree to be a buddy to a new child coming in and care for them and keep an eye on them and make sure they're okay. So a new kid in the school always knows there's somebody to contact and talk to about things.
What about the grown-ups? The bullying among...
Exactly. The colleagues. The bullying in the workplace.
Yeah.
And also teachers bullying each other, not just bullying their pupils, but also, you know, it goes all the way around. Teacher to teacher to pupil, pupil to other pupil.
Yeah.
And again, if you think about it, it links back with empathy again.
Mm-hmm.
If you have some understanding how someone else feels, you wouldn't bully them.
No, because you wouldn't want to. Come on, if you know how it hurts if somebody does that to you, so you wouldn't do it to somebody else. No. Mm. So you're trying to say that also the people who are bullying, they're kind of sociopaths because they do not have empathy for the others.
Mm-hmm.
And that is causing the childhood, yeah? The causes are usually in the childhood, the early childhood, right?
Mm. Absolutely. Mm. And it's to do with wanting to feel some power.
Mm.
The child who bullies feels powerful. But for example, in Malaysia, the rise in teenage suicide is really very worrying, particularly amongst the Chinese population, of children getting bullied so much, in the end they kill themselves. It's a very, very worrying thing when you get children killing themselves, you know, 12, 13-year-olds. So something's got to change somewhere, and nobody is quite sure where.
It's everywhere, not only in Malaysia and China, as far as I know. So it's like something is not functioning the whole planet, no?
Mm-hmm. And of course, parents don't always understand bullying. You know, they say to the child, well, hit him back. You know, give as good as you get. And it actually doesn't work that way. The bully has got far more power in terms of threats and what they're going to do to the child if they don't give them money, if they don't do their homework for them. And I mean, it's not just hitting people. It's a constant, pervasive challenging of another child who actually ends up doing things for the bully in order to stop being harassed.
Yeah. Mm. Verbal bullying is painful as much as it's physical.
Mm.
And the grown-ups, it's more on verbal level, yeah? Or a psychological pressure. Or I mean, I think there are many ways how somebody can bully somebody else.
But it's also a rather mean thing, doing mean things to other people. In little ways to hurt them. And of course, the worst one is when you get your cyberbullying, and that's still on the increase, despite them putting in safeguards. And people photoshopping somebody, either distressed or in a compromising position, or reacting with fear and putting it on social media.
Some of the social media is actually really destructive, at least to me, because exposing or maybe even, as you said, it's photoshopping, so it's completely constructed.
I mean, there was a terrible situation in Ireland a little while ago when a group of teenagers set an elderly tramp, on fire, and then filmed his distress at being very, very severely burnt, and then putting it on social media as a joke, you know?
That's not a joke.
I mean,
that's not a joke.
But you see, this is where we come back to the lack of empathy, that actually not one of those teenagers had any remorse about that they were actually hurting somebody. To them, it was just an old tramp. Why not? Let's have some fun. Mm. But it was a very shocking thing at the time. Mm. And it's also something about, how shall I say, does one's life actually feel worthwhile? If you actually enjoy life, enjoy what you do, enjoy what you study, enjoy what you play, then I think you have a very different outlook on life, and you don't bully. And
no, you don't have a reason, because you have enough other things to do. So It's getting really dark, and I know you must be exhausted after the workshop and everything.
I'm actually enjoying myself very much. Mm. I just wanted to add one more dimension, if I could, briefly.
Yeah. Sure.
And that's to do with the whole concept of rhythm.
Rhythm.
And again, through my research with neurodramatic play, I think every individual develops their own rhythm of life. Mm-hmm. It's very slow to start with. The babies have been in the dark for 9 months. They have to differentiate between night and day and all these things. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens when there's abuse or trauma, people's rhythm then gets disrupted and they have to rediscover their own rhythm. Now, what you saw with the tribe was very, very interesting, because not only do they have regular sessions of singing and dancing with a very highly developed rhythm, and there's a, like a group of women beating out rhythms on a bamboo stompers while the shaman is singing and so on, they also live on bamboo sprung floors. So every time you move, you're getting a sense of rhythm. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think the Temia, living with this permanent rhythm all the time, helps them to be more regulated in terms of what they do in their life, how they manage it, and so on. Whereas we can very easily get dysregulated in terms of of rhythm. Do you see what my...
Yeah, I get you, because I know also that the children with special needs, if you have irregular rhythm, they will feel totally lost. So you need to provide them a regular rhythm. Mm. And as far as I know, the humans are creatures of habits. So if you keep disrupting somebody in their, I don't know, the daily routine, it won't be a happy person, you know. The rhythm does give us a frame in which we feel somehow safe and secure, and the things goes, I mean, you have a sense that you can control or at least see where you're going at, yeah. But I can imagine if you don't have that sense, it's a total chaos, no?
Exactly.
What's going on?
So we need to have the chanting.
Bit, yeah. We need a continuum.
Yes, we need to have the rituals.
So in that sense, you're also implementing, like, let's say the work therapies, like singing in a choir. You mentioned the dance therapy, right? So I believe all this participation in certain groups can be more healthy than not doing nothing, no?
Absolutely. So we need the arts.
Definitely.
That's my closing statement. We need the arts.
So thank you so much.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.